I remember looking at the screen and seeing the pan of the audience after we did the songs, and I was like, oh, that was something. Like, to see Nashville standing up clapping was, they killed it. They hooked, line, and sinkered everybody, and it was a historical performance.
My name's Johnny Reinhardt, and I've lived in Southwest Michigan most of my life. It's such a wonderful community full of so many great things, but the best part is the people, families, history, and especially the stories that make it great. And with every story, you have to start somewhere. This is Start From the Beginning, Stories from Southwest Michigan. Welcome to episode 14, and I'm really, really excited for you to hear my conversation with Paul Clemson. He is a guy that is just really cool, to be honest, and I consider him a friend as well as my neighbor. He lives actually not too far down the road from me here in Niles, but speaking of the road, he spent a lot of his time and part of his life on the road, touring with a lot of different bands as a sound engineer and that guy behind the scenes that makes everything sound amazing. We'll talk a little bit about that. Plus, we're going to talk about what he's doing here in Southwest Michigan. It's something I think is really great. So we'll talk about all of that stuff. But first, let's start from the beginning with Paul Clemson. Well, hey, Paul.
How's it going, Johnny?
How you doing, buddy?
Good.
This is like the second or third conversation I think you and I have had, but a lot of conversations off air and about all kinds of different things. But much like the show is called, I want to start from the beginning. So first, where did Paul Clemson come from?
Paul came from Whiteside County in Illinois, which is the top left corner of Illinois. No, I'm not from Chicago. When you tell people you're from Illinois.
Yeah.
Straight west of Chicago, probably 4 hours, 5 minutes from the Mississippi River, corn, cows, and lots of flat land.
And what's so funny is that you have made your way from the flat land to all kinds of, you know, big cities, all around the world. But you've also now made it back to flat land. You're actually right down the road from me as I sit right now in Niles. But yeah. I want to talk about your journey. So you were in Illinois growing up. What was life like growing up in Illinois?
All the typical kind of Midwest things, sports, roller skating rink on Friday night, chasing the girls. I was heavy into music, heavy into church. Grew up in a church family and volunteered a whole bunch, heavy in the community. Dad was in Kiwanis and the VFW. And, I always helped put out flags for Veteran Days with Dad and take them down. And Memorial Day, he would help arrange the parade. So a lot of service growing up and, hard work, Illinois, that's what it built you for. Got into the farming community. I was a townie, as they called us, but the pay on a farm was much better than the pay at McDonald's, Hardee's at the time when Hardee's was open. Got into farming and found another level of hard work. Did all the kind of country things, drove trucks and motorcycles. But then music pulled me in, played piano as a kid, 6 years old to 8 or 9. That led into that fifth grade moment where they say what instrument you want to play in band, and you tried all the instruments, and percussion landed in my lap. So took home the pad set and the bells and annoyed mom with them. But my brother also had a drum set in the basement, and I wanted to be like him. He was my older brother, so I would sneak down there and bang on him. When he moved out, I pulled out all the pots and pans, and mom was like, I think we need to do something about this.
Right.
Got a drum set by collecting pop cans and changing them in 25 cents a pound. So they covered half of it, and I paid the other half with recycling.
25 cents a pound? That's how you recycled there?
I'm pretty sure that's what the going rate in the 80s was.
Okay, so you're not, and not being from Michigan. See, being growing up in Michigan, it was always the 10 cents for the can. So that was helpful. But yeah, to having to go to a recycling center and do all that definitely takes determination on your part, and a lot of going around and trying to find stuff to recycle. So, so did you stick with drums? Did you start a band? Was there Paul Clemson and the whatever trio?
My high school career ended in a band called Pet Raven. We were originals, and our town had a lot of music, a lot of bands that sprung up. Brothers, you know, Brothers Watching Brothers. A friend of mine, it was Danny Duffy. His brother Jim was the first kind of person who taught me how to sit behind the drums, hold the sticks. You know, at the end of four beats, you hit the cymbal because that's just what we learned from listening to records.
Yeah.
So Jim really took me under his wing for a little bit, but then just right into lessons at high school, playing in jazz band. But it started with Nirvana, eighth grade. Nevermind came out, and Clemson with a K next to Kemmer with a K in eighth grade graduation lineup. And he kind of looked over and was like, you want to start a Nirvana cover band? Because that's what you would do to be able to play the parties in the summer.
Yeah.
So that started it, and then got in with a couple other bands, and you know, ended up being in a band with a couple dudes writing music. And that was the start of Pet Raven about sophomore year.
Wow. And so did people, what was the people in the community? And I mean, were they loving the Nirvana cover band? I mean, cause you're in the middle of Illinois. were people into that grunge era?
Yeah, very much so. Back when I was younger, even with engineering and music, the only influx of kind of culture was, well, MTV came about.
Yeah.
So that was huge. But reading Rolling Stone, whoever had a cousin somewhere that brought a tape with them, you know, like Beastie Boys showed up in one of our friends' trucks and was like, what is this? And, you know, only what you ever get there was county fair cover band rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, all the 50s and 60s stuff. So after seeing, and there was a lot of that, there was always like a weekly kind of car show where, you know, the county fair came around, backyards. When grunge hit, it really did kind of take over a lot of kids' minds in junior, that late eighth grade, high school. I graduated in 97. So it was right that like 95, 96 was huge. It kind of changed, that pack of kids that we were together. It changed a lot of our lives.
Absolutely. And I really would say even when it comes to, like you mentioned, being at the church and that era of, I think, of Christian music was changing so much at that time. You know, Jars of Clay, Audio Adrenaline, and bands like that. It was a total shift from even my childhood that I remember. It was a total shift of what the sound of what Christian music should sound like. It totally took it on a different path. And to me, I enjoyed it as a kid that loved a lot of the other, you know, the Nirvanas and the Pearl Jams and bands like that. I was like, this is music I can get on board with for sure.
You just opened a big Pandora's box. Cause that was, you're telling me my story. That was, since we were in church, there definitely was things I couldn't have in the house. Yeah, typical of, you know, that era. And yeah, that was the alternative. You know, this is something that sounds like something other people were listening to. And if I couldn't listen to that in my house, I don't think there was any hard and fast rules. It was just kind of like, take it easy on that music. I remember the theme at that point, kind of in the Christian world of youth, was be careful what you put in your head. Don't ingest too much of it. I knew the old 12 CDs for a penny on Columbia. I knew a lot of friends in my youth group who would get a pile of CDs. And then you kind of have this moment where I'm like, where friends would get rid of their secular music as a cleansing and a coming out, a kind of coming out thing for the Christian world. And it's interesting having that discussion about music and what it does to us on a daily basis. But that's, life did lead from Illinois into Greenville College in Illinois, Southern Illinois. And that's where Jars of Clay came from.
Yeah.
And being in that environment as an engineer and coming up with other bands from that college, it sucked me right into the CCM scene in Nashville, right at that time period. The first tour I was on ever on a real tour bus was, let me see if I get this right. Jenny Varnado, Stereo Deluxe. And I can't remember the closer, but it was like a classic Christian rock band. And that tour sucked me right into The Waiting and Small Town Poets, which were some Atlanta bands.
Yep.
And that sucked me right into Supertones, Five Iron Frenzy, Ace Troubleshooter, Reliant K. I mean, it was, you know, the type of Christian band, Christian tour where there's five bands a night.
Right.
Kind of all sharing buses. The drummer from the opener was the headliner. You know, like it was just all, it was just that big Kool-Aid of CCM bands.
Yeah. And it was kind of like, it was kind of like a family. And like yes. you said, so did you ever, when you were growing up in church, did, because you being and having a career as a sound engineer, which we'll get to later on in the story. But you, did you ever, you know, run sound for the church or do anything like that? What got you into getting behind a soundboard instead of behind a set of drums?
My dad, he was one of the trustees of the church, and it went from the Altec Lansing four knob, you know, like,
yep,
to the first Mackie 12 channel 8 bus consoles. And when it came out, Mackie's manuals were brilliant on their part because they bridged kind of the gap between the technology, which kind of prior to the budget console era, mm-hmm. to become a recording engineer, you built your own stuff. The Les Pauls, the Bill Putnams, you know, every studio was based around a console, and usually that console was hand wired. A lot of technology coming from Telegraph studio, like the old school Telegraph patch bay and Navy plug type. Since you like patch bays came from that. So that was the first time when audio became kind of accessible to the general public, much like when, you know, interfaces and laptops mm-hmm. replaced the main studio. But the church I was in went from, you know, organ and voice only to piano, drums, keyboards, singers. And it was kind of like I was probably 9 or 10. And it was like, get that kid away from there. Don't let him touch the things, to where'd that kid go? And I'd read the manual and it stuck. It really stuck. And I knew that I could fake drumming. Like I could listen to stuff and play it. And rhythm was definitely important, but I could breathe audio. I could see how it got from there to here and all the stops along the way. And that's when it took over. Our band started recording first 2-track in the basement, just, you know, as we played with the boombox stereo mics on the front of it. And then 4-track as friends bought the analog tape machines. And then, you know, we played enough gigs to scrounge up $400 to drive to Iowa City and go to a proper studio. And being the drummer, you're done early
right.
on a 3-song demo. So I sat there and dude gave me some headphones and I was sitting next to an outboard effects box just going, what is this thing?
Yeah.
It, you know, it spurs on the imagination at that point.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that it also the manual is something, yeah, that people need to read and look at. But there's a separation between people that know how to do something like that and, you know, just technically, but mm-hmm. to be able to do it and to hear it and understand what's going on. Do you think your foundation in music that you had when you were a kid, the piano yes. and playing the drums and all that kind of really got you into, oh, I not only do I see and know where the knobs need to go, but I also can hear what needs to happen and what's going to sound good.
Yes. Ear training. Every good engineer has a vocabulary of sounds, and you know, a metal engineer has their toolbox and vocabulary, like a kick drum is supposed to sound like this, a snare drum is supposed to sound like this in that genre. And yeah, playing in all the ensembles in high school was huge because, and as a percussionist, because you're in the back. So mm-hmm. when you move from timpani over on the stage left, you're catching all the trumpets. You're closer. You're yeah. As I call it, your concert experience is wherever you're standing. And as an audience member, if you're downstage left, you're going to catch more of stage right guitar player right in the face. So whatever the PA is doing is getting influenced by that. And I think, and then, you know, in percussion, you move over to the bells on the right for a song and you catch all the woodwinds. So being inside the music that way, structurally, you know, physically moving around a space, I could see how percussion would totally lend to a different auditory experience than just sitting in your section, you know, in the arch,
right.
But then throwing it into small ensembles, jazz bands, and how the communication is between musicians. You know, obviously that's kind of a level three Jedi skill in jazz, but that led to when I was in the band, I always listened to the vocal when I was playing. Mm-hmm. It was a three piece bass, guitar, and drums. And if we had wedges, you know, if it was a place that would have that, I would always just take vocal because I can hear the bass just from the amp in the room. And if I can follow the vocal, and he was a trumpet player as well and had band training. If I could follow the vocal, we'd be fine. It was just, that was just my roadmap of where we were going.
Yeah.
And cluing in on some of the, little auditory nuances from a voice, everybody has to breathe. So there's a breath in things. There's a, and people use that same analogy of a breath as a, in music, as a resting spot. You know, people are like, oh, that performance really breathed. And what that means is it stopped at some point. The sentence would be, you know, and then it stops and rests. And same thing with the vocal, lead vocalists, the breaths are where I found my timing.
Wow. Yeah. And it's just like, I mean, technically it's what I think of it when it comes to, as any concert, when you go to a concert, that is what makes or breaks a good concert. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the smallest venue or the largest venue, if it doesn't sound good coming out of those speakers, those people that are in the back, it's not going to be a great experience. So it's, I attribute it to like paint by numbers. Some people can paint by numbers and do it technically well, but it's the people that paint the picture and that's what you're doing behind the soundboard, because that's the experience that people are going to get. Cause most of them are not going to be, none of them are, especially in any concert, you're not going to be standing next to the musician and hearing that regular sound. You may hear it in the front row, but what you're experiencing is what people like you are doing for them. And so, yeah, you got to be able to paint the picture. And if you can't, then you shouldn't be behind the soundboard. But at what point did you realize, hey, I'm kind of good at this?
Probably the first check from the Small Town Poets, when it was like a check with, no, I'm sorry. It was a band called The Normals. They were out of Greenville as well. Mark Lockett, Andrew Osinga, he's still a producer, songwriter, brilliant, just wonderfully awesome man. They were all great people, but I've had the most experience with Andrew and Mark Lockett, and they had gone to the college as well. And the day I was dropping out of college, Mark, the guitar player, was coming in. I think his fiance was getting signed up or something. And I was like, hey, like I knew who he was. They were known at that point. And he goes, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm here to go to Nashville. I'm leaving college. And he goes, oh, we're playing this weekend. You want to mix us? And that was the first like non-student related mix I had done. You know, everything else was kind of practice, and that was totally it. Just getting the check and being like, this is something, people will give me money for this.
Were you scared when you first did the non like school related thing, when that friend said, hey, I mean, he obviously trusted you, but did you get to a point where you maybe like, there's a band that called you up and said, hey, I heard through the grapevine that you're pretty good at what you do, can you do this for us? Were you ever scared that you might not, you know, be up to par what they thought you'd be?
You know, it's that old adage of as you get older, you know less.
Yeah.
And I think young Paul scares old Paul, because young Paul dove off a lot of high diving boards without any water in the pool. But the last 20 years were just teeny tiny cuts. Like I could draw exactly this one led to this one. And it was from the moment I touched the first console, like everything, I was always a little ahead of the requirement of the gig I was on.
Yeah.
And I tell this, my nephews are in audio now. They were shut down for COVID, but before that, my nephew Alec was, went to Columbia in Chicago for audio and was popped out right into the House of Blues there. Like he walked away from college with a gig, and that was all through, you know, nothing. I don't know if the college helped him at all, but he definitely was hitting the pavement strong freshman year even. and got on a street team to hand out flyers, which got him into the venue every night. And I was like, hey, stand next to the sound guy. Next night, hey, ask him to wrap cables with him afterwards. And like a week later, he's like, hey, I got a gig. I'm like, that's how you do it. Yeah. Just coming up, it was like, dive into things. And if you're cruising and coasting, figure out the next step and work on it on their time, because you'll make their gig better, but you also prepare yourself for the next step. And that's another thing too. And especially in audio gig based, it's kind of like you're always looking for that next challenge. It could be inside the gig you're on. It could be the next thing you're going to. But like we said about manuals, I've not stopped learning gear. I feel behind. It's really spread out. And in my older age, it's like, do I really need to learn that one widget? Do I need to spend is 3 hours in the manual, worth it for this new widget? But I always look to the youth now and let them educate me on new technology if I'm on gigs.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that there are two types of people probably that you've ran into, is those people that are constantly learning. And then there's just that old, this is how I do things. This is how it's done. And any new technology and stuff, that it's worthless and I don't need to use it because I know what it sounds like.
And there's a lot of, I've looked up to a lot of older engineers and sat in on a few of their gigs and flew their rigs. Martino McBride comes to mind. Bull is an engineer who is from Tampico, Illinois, or Cordova, Illinois, which is strange because we're both farm boys, and found out later on that we were from the same area. But he mixed on the Rolling Stones. But his other gigs, one of them was Martin McBride, and it was his console settings. It was his wedge package that he built for her with John McBride, who owns Blackbird Studios in Nashville, and he's very much drives Martina's live sound, obviously studio sound as well. But I kind of walked into a system that was already built and was able to pick his pocket and kind of poke around and go, oh, here's how the big boys do it, and the mentality of, she was all wedges. Like there was like one band member on ears. It was kind of some old school country where they're on stage listening to each other audibly instead of pumping things into in ears. But it was fun just to kind of, step around someone's world for a minute and see the parallels.
Yeah. And that constant learning is probably something that has continued to get you other gigs and other things and new experiences. And would you say you're still kind of like young Paul, kind of diving right in, or do you, is it more a methodical kind of approach to how you do that next job? Because obviously tours end, and maybe an artist may call you back and say, I want you to be continuing as my touring sound guy, but what's next? I mean, I'm just looking at the laundry list of artists that you've been able to work with. And I mean, it's just the upper echelon of artists that, with John Legend, Drake, Justin Timberlake, The Roots, you worked on The Tonight Show. What's something that you would say was your favorite, tour to go on?
Oh my goodness. Oh, there's so many,
picking a favorite child, but
I know
being on the spot,
and it's not going to hurt anybody's feelings, because they were all amazing bosses and inspiring humans to be around. Obviously at that level, you have to function at a certain, not only micro, but macro, everybody around you was functioning at such a high level, from lighting to the people who come in and fly the speakers in the morning. Time is, once you say go to a tour, so you spend all the pre-production getting it right, making sure the rig can come in and out of arenas. Obviously this is for 33 buses and 30 semi tours, the Taylor Swift arena, the U2 in the stadiums, like those type of things take a massive amount of coordination and planning. And I mean, there's 88 humans on the Timberlake crew that moved with it, not to mention a couple band buses, because there's 16 people on stage, 6 dancers, a whole team of, back office management, right, that move along with it to do their functions in the day, interface with the audience, make sure ticketing is right, get all the seats filled. Maybe there's a section that gets blocked by lighting, move them. But yeah, that moment we left rehearsals, you're kind of in the tube, like the spaceship is left.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like being in space. Bring what you need, you know, make sure you have a couple spares of the important show stoppers. It's just a great experience to be a part of. You know, you walk into a room in the morning and there's nothing in it. It's a dark arena with the floor covered if there's ice, and you start chalking out, as they do, 6 a.m. chalk walk, where they measure on the floor where the motors are supposed to go in the air. And by noon, there's a stage and lights and PA. Work lights are still on, so it still feels a little basketball-ish. But then that 2 o'clock where they click off the house lights and lighting starts to program and make sure everything's working and audio's starting to do the walkthrough of the, you know, like we're listening to all the zones, you know, there's stage hands doing the stage, putting the drums up and getting the mics on it. I mean, it's just a city of ants. Mm-hmm. And really by the third week, you're in, you know, almost muscle memory, especially on a show like Timberlake, where he wants it the same every night.
Sure.
Obviously I'm trying to like give him a little energy here and there because he does have a live band. You can find nuances of, you know, Mike's got the guitar player is kind of going for it tonight. And you just give him a goose. But for the most part, mechanically, the show is mixed, is the same. That doesn't exclude the outside forces of, I keep shaving off the edges a little bit. Like some scenes you get into, you know, a song, I'm like, I haven't had time to work on a certain section. Sure. Because you need the audience and the band playing. You can't just kind of, you know, figure it out the day after. So the file did get better over 2 years, but it was definitely muscle memory, you know, into it.
Yeah. What would you rather choose? Something that is, you know, that constant, consistent tour, or something that, say, like, I'm sure with the Tonight Show, when you were doing that and with the Roots, and were you also working on when they would have a guest artist or things like that? Was that something that would be like, hey, we've got this artist that's coming in and they're playing the show tonight. Mm-hmm. Did you have to do something like that?
Yeah. Fallon was college. Late night was awesome because we were pretty left alone. Obviously, the forces that be were focused on Leno and Conan at the time. And we kind of skirted under the radar. They we did a lot of sketches that were just fun and exciting and a little on the edge, but we were the 1 a.m. show. And that also left a lot of room for music. Mm-hmm. The booker at the time, Jonathan Cohen, was courting bands and taking years to get like a Frank Ocean to come on, doing mashups with the Roots. And so when I walked in day one of Fallon, it was a sprint for 2 years. Jimmy was pushing the envelope. We would do like post show sketches and tapings that were, you know, if it had a musical element, I was there doing monitors for the Roots and Jimmy. He did Wedges. He can play and sing,
yeah.
Kirk would coach him along and the guys would, you know, help him out. But he's dead on when he's doing the Bob Dylan stuff, I'm blanking on the couple of other ones that he did, but anytime he did the dress ups where he was pretending to be an artist, he would be into it. Like, that's taught me like this really big commitment. If you're going to do it, you know, he'd show up with a picture and just be sitting there looking at the hat and the light angle and knowing how to tell the director, Dave, like, hey, this is, can we move it? And everybody was in. Everybody was like focused on that moment. And that always feels good. Like I always say, kind of, I'll chase crazy with an artist. Like, I'll chase their ingenuity and creativity as far as they want to go if they're in it, because you're along for the ride. And a lot of times you're just so focused and then you look up and you see kind of what in-house audience, what they're reacting to versus stuff you read on Twitter the next day, once it plays that night. And then you kind of go, whoa, that was something. But it's just this, like, the attention's so sucked in at the moment, mm-hmm. when you're creating it, that the rest of the world doesn't exist. And it may be crap. It may be like, you know, this is the dumbest sketch we've ever done.
Right.
I don't remember any times when I was like, that's weird. it was all very exciting back then. But I'd have to say, you know, my favorite gig would probably have been the Timberlake Stapleton CMAs when they mashed up together. It was Chris's 5-piece band, mashed with Justin's 16-piece band, all live instruments, which is unheard of for big shows. Usually it's tape playback with the live, the vocalist singing. And these two insisted that it be live because it's Chris Stapleton. You know, he doesn't do tracks.
No.
And it was just such a sprint to get the two bands together to rehearse, and they were making changes on the fly, just creatively, like when to throw lines to each other for each person's song. And, you know, Timberlake's band's looking at Chris's band, and then all of a sudden it just clicked. And I remember doing the performance, and it was just massively stressful because there were so many people on stage and it was, you know, live. And then looking up, and they tuck monitors like behind the scenes, you get a screen. It's usually about that big. And I remember looking at the screen and seeing the pan of the audience after we did the songs. And I was like, oh, that was something. Like to see Nashville standing up clapping was, you know, usually it's all impressed me, but
right.
They killed it. They hook, line, sinker to everybody. And it was a historical performance.
Yeah. And obviously it's very stressful. Like you said, that not only having these two major artists working together, the multiple bands mashing all together and doing all that, but also, like you said, Nashville, mm-hmm. hard to please kind of community, because they're just so jaded with their, you know, they have upper tier artists all the time coming through there, you know, cause that's the hub of especially country music, but a lot of music going through there.
Music now. Yeah.
So it's crazy. So what brought you to this area? I mean, because we can fast forward a little bit, and you know, this past year, I'm sure, has, would you say, with this slowdown of not having a tour, obviously that's been a stress, but has it been a relief as well?
Yeah, it's the first time in life where it feels like it's not like a good moment, then a bad moment. Then it doesn't feel like it's like mostly good with challenges. Life's kind of been that up until now. It's just kind of this, every moment is the most high and the most low, mostly because, you know, you lose your identity when your entire industry shuts down for any time. And, you know, I just did a gig this weekend and I wasn't even mixing, but just to put on my technical brain for a minute was really weird. Even coming back yesterday, I was still in road mode, as we call it. I was still going way too fast for, you know, what needed to happen at home. So yeah, I think getting 8 hours of sleep a night for an entire year has been a bad thing, because the the tank is now full, and I can't get it all out fast enough. And the ideas come very quickly. And plus plowing through a bunch of old kind of, you know, some mental health things from over the years. I'm peeling the onion and just seeing, because we would do stuff and then you're right on the bus and you're right out the door and you're doing the same thing the next night, and things get buried and things kind of get washed under. And the freelance lifestyle is tough because you don't know where the next gig is coming from. Even if, you know, as good as you are and as many people as you work for, the phone does stop ringing. You know, you hit those kind of points in time where your four or five artists aren't doing anything. They're off in the studio. Or nowadays, I was with Kelly Clarkson for a bit, and as you said, I was with John Legend, and they both got voice gigs. And so and Kelly got a TV show. And so either you bring your crew into the studio, which, back to the roots, yes, the roots were wherever the roots played for those 5 years, I was there. So weekdays, 5 days a week, 48 weeks a year, and then weekends and some weeknights after Fallon tapings, we go down to somewhere in Manhattan and do shows. And it's lucky that, you know, they brought most of their crew into the studio, because otherwise that road crew goes to something else and sometimes does weekend shows when that artist has time. So yeah, coming from freelance, you just worked so much so that, you know, I could count the days off in 2019 on one hand. You miss birthdays, you miss anniversaries, you kind of cauterize saying goodbye. Like it just becomes a breath and you're out the door again, suitcase in hand. And it's a great road life, but there's the life back home that you have to remember. Courtney and I, from the beginning, have really worked hard on a home road life balance. We built kind of tools along the way, like yeses and nos, just kind of parameters on whether or not to take a gig and when to stop. And how long we can be away from each other, and those type of things. And as we, you know, as you get bigger, you can have a few more says in that. But yeah, the beginning was a lot of sacrifice.
And your wife also goes on tours as well, right?
She's in production. I've toured the most. She's done a lot of, we always say she pops up for the big ones. So yeah, she was in a, she worked for an audio shop with me in New Jersey back when we got there. She got to production manage U2 on Top of the Rock for the first Tonight Show. Her cooking got her that gig, which is interesting. She's always feeding people and it turns into conversations, and all of a sudden she's, you know, taking care of artists and stuff in a different way. So yeah, she's been there the whole way through all of it, all the growths from van and trailer, all the way up to tour buses, and we've shared a lot of that life together.
I love how food can get her the gig. I mean, like, here, try this. You like that? While you're eating, I'm gonna pitch this at you and see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's been the theme of our marriage and our involvement in the industry, is just taking care of people. It is tough out there, and yeah, Luckily she was able to come along quite a bit and be around a lot of tours stage left. Monitor world is on stage left. In monitors, you only see this much of the person. You're always looking at them from across stage. So, yeah, she was in stage left quite a bit, and, you know, we'd have people back to our hotel rooms if they needed to chat. Luckily on Timberlake, we were in New Jersey rehearsing, and she came over and took up residence at the hotel as well that we were at. And we opened up our room every night, cause we were in a county that was a blue code county. So they shut down at 9 o'clock and there was nothing to do after nine. But that spawned a lot of great conversations, a lot of things that came out in that time period, with people turned into what we started as the Roadie Clinic. And that was the proving grounds back then.
Yeah. And the Roadie Clinic right there. And you chose Niles to be the place for the Roadie Clinic, which is odd too, because, you know, like you said, become a guy from Illinois. You've been in New York City and all that. But people in Southwest Michigan, we know that we're sort of that in between road of where, artists tour. I mean, between Chicago, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Indianapolis, and places like that, it's that you can pretty much draw a dot and right in Southwest Michigan say, oh, that's a good spot to take a breather.
That was the idea.
You chose it that way?
Yes, we absolutely chose it, Niles, for many reasons. It fell in our lap, essentially. We've been coming here the last 6-7 years. Courtney's cousins live here on the edge of town on Niles Buchanan Road, and they have an oasis of a property, and we would just come and relax and chill. And then as we learned downtown more and, you know, all the great restaurants here, it was like, this has something going on. As the beginning ideas of the clinic formulated, a building became available downtown, and it was just kind of a eureka moment of, there's no brick and mortar where that roadies can call home other than rehearsal studios and shops that we've been to. You know, there's definitely a lot of places that I'm fond of going to, but a non-touring stop away from the world and work is what we were looking for as a place to come take respite, as in physically. Yeah. Then it already backs up, you know, kind of the stuff we're building online as well, because, you know, we have to be everywhere roadies get to go. It just hits a lot of buttons being right off the interstate and just far enough away, but close enough that Chicago, Detroit, South Bend, you know, those are the closest airports.
Yeah. And I think that is something that is needed. Like you said, you know, there is no place, you know, you go to, whether you maybe have some time in a hotel room and have somebody to talk to, but that sort of just place to chill out, unplug, unwind sort of feeling, or just somebody to talk to about what's going on. And like you said, it's that peeling of the onion of everything, because you don't stop when you're out on tour. Like you said, it's pretty much from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, you're working, doing something. So you don't have that time to really even realize and turn that focus back to you, your family, and life outside of being on the road. So what's next? I mean, obviously you continue to work on and build, physically build, but also build the awareness of the Roadie Clinic. But what's next for you and your career, as well as this really awesome thing that you've started, and this movement, I think, of something like the Roadie Clinic?
Definitely. I mean, you nailed it. Last year, we were, as far as the Roadie Clinic goes, we were doing completely awareness and get in front of everybody and get involved with all the other great organizations that are out there. We are one of the only crew-based nonprofits. A lot of the other nonprofits are musician crew, but we really felt in our heart that the crew is our baby to support and have resources for. This year is more, I mean, that set the trajectory for that this year, and Courtney is just plowing along on the partnerships, getting a list of services, of packages of services together that we can offer to tour managements, which we've already had a large tour management from a very well-known band reach out and say, what would you have available for our crew in August? And what was funny was, is like, well, we haven't started that yet. It's already in the works, but speak into it. You're the client. You tell us what you want for your crew and how to take care of them. Because last year, part of Courtney's direction was to figure out what was out there and who's doing it and who's the person she can call to get those services for our crew people, and then check back with our crew people and say, did that work? Mm-hmm. Did these people get, because it's just not sending them somewhere. It's then having that relationship to know that they can call back and say, hey, that was great, but I need a little more of. So, so our trajectory on the Roadie Clinic has definitely been set by the partnerships and the people we helped last year. Even though we're not open physically, we're open here in our apartment in downtown Niles, right across the street from the clinic. And we've been lucky enough to have the resources and people come along to help. I think the number is 60 now, 60 roadies, some here and most where they're at, where they were taking cover for COVID. Personally, I have become completely enamored with the Michigan music scene. I mean, for years, I've just had these tuggings, no matter where we're at, that there wasn't much room for any newness in the scenes that I got to pass through, as well as picking up the nuggets of the cool parts of the club the Roots played in Poland that we just passed through. It was only 200 people. What was cool about that? What was great about the O2 in the UK and London? Playing Roskilde Music Festival and how they had their backstage and how cool it was to kind of like mingle in their backstage with other crews, with other artists, and everybody was just kind of picnicking. So over the years, collecting all those gems, And when I came to Niles, when we came to Michigan to start really looking at Niles, not just coming to vacation, Bill Chrysler up in Grand Haven was just this beacon for the music scene. Like, it was just like, look what Michigan's doing. Mm-hmm. We have the Michigan Music Alliance, and they've accepted us in and supporting us, as well as, you know, we're going to cultivate events with them as well to do more Michigan music here in Niles. I definitely will take our time to get things going. We don't want to just abruptly, you know, edge our way into a new locale. I love all the people here we've met that are super passionate about Niles. There's a lot of youth coming into, I say youth, but I'm talking about myself. and you know, my age of youth, I still feel very young. Maybe touring has stunted me or kept me young. But just seeing the energy going into the downtown and the owners, meeting them, hanging out at the Node, just meeting the downtown people who love it here and see the value and, you know, some of the untapped resources down here that could kind of spring the next, you know, 5-10 years into making it vibrant.
Yeah, you're the townie that's now meeting the townies in a different. I know, yeah. Which is great. And I'm so glad that I've been able to meet you, and I look forward to more conversations about all kinds of different things. And you know, we've only touched on a little bit of your story, but I want to ask you, I usually ask everybody about this. What's something that someone might not know about you?
Huh? A deep, dark secret.
Yeah.
Gosh. Something someone might not know that's of interest. That's really tough. Why is it so hard? Something that someone might not. Oh.
What's the first thing that came to mind? Because I know that's the thing, is every time I ask somebody this, they have that self-reflection. But I know there was something that immediately came to mind.
I really enjoy putting on an apron and helping my wife cook. It's just a lot of fun to be her sous chef. Yeah. I think that was part of, you know, I'd get home off the road and almost beg to do the dishes.
Sure.
Like, and to just reconnect. And I think that's where the cooking thing comes from. Cause I mean, when I met her, I thought that you opened the tomato soup can, and put it in the thing and heat it up, and didn't ever read the instructions, and didn't know you put a can of water or milk in with it. So she's watching me do this one time, and this is, you know, years ago, and she's like, "What are you doing?" And so it became her. It's been her mission to domesticate me for many years. But no, I think getting into the kitchen with her and cooking.
Yeah.
And
would your meal get you a job if you made something? Cause I know, like you said, your wife and her wonderful cooking, but also that also sparked that conversation to help maybe get a job and things like that. But do you feel like you could make a meal that could get you your next gig?
Only if it was someone like tomato soup and grilled cheese, maybe my apple crisp could get me a job. If there was like an apple crisp store.
Okay.
That would do it, especially Michigan apples. That's just the best.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You've got great ingredients. You just have to be able to, hey, you're good at reading manuals. So I feel like you'd be good at reading a recipe.
I do the baking because it's scientific.
Yep.
I mean, she does her breads and stuff, but if it's like, you got to read the book and do it step by step and measure, that's this guy. And I'll line up all the ingredients. Yep. It's just like mixing a record. It's like, you need your base. It's like, oh, I like
instructions. It has to happen, just like when you're trying to balance the sound of something. I'm the same way when it comes to that. Oh. Paul, it's been great talking to you. I do want to ask you this question. I ask people this as well. If you were to title an autobiography, you know, maybe starting from right now, what would you title?
Well, that worked.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, it's always good to talk to you. I look forward to more conversations with you, but thank you so much for taking just a little snippet of time to get a glimpse of your story.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you for listening to Start From the Beginning, Stories from Southwest Michigan. Special thanks to our guests for telling their stories. And if you have a story to tell, I'd love to hear more. Please reach out to me by emailing letstalk@wsjm.com. That's letstalk@wsjm.com. You can listen to this podcast and all the episodes wherever you like to listen to podcasts, and be sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. This is a Midwest Family production. I'm Johnny Reinhart. Join me next time for another great story on Start From the Beginning, Stories from Southwest Michigan.